Hi, and welcome to Inside Intercom. Today I'm joined by Samuel Hulick, who is the writer and founder of User Onboard. Samuel, thanks so much for joining us.
It is an absolute pleasure to be here.
So I believe most of our readers will be pretty familiar with a lot of your work. You've done a lot of teardowns of many popular products, explaining exactly how they onboard new users and basically achieve their business goals. To get straight into it, what do you define as onboarding for a product?
So my definition of onboarding might be a little bit different than what a conventional one is. Specifically, I identify it as any time there's an opportunity for people to increase the likelihood that their users are successful when trying to adopt their product. So not just an intro tour or things along those lines, but basically anytime that you can close that gap between somebody is seeing what they can be capable of with your product and actually be successful in doing that.
That's interesting. So by that definition, does onboarding ever stop?
Right. So that's the other question. I think that you could make a very strong case for, once again, looking at that, anytime there's a gap between what people are currently doing and what your product would make them capable of, that there's an opportunity for onboarding there. So a very simple example would be if somebody's been using your product for 6 months, totally up to speed, and you release a brand new feature that's going to significantly increase what their abilities are, certainly an onboarding moment opportunity there.
Sure. So you have like probably a general sense of onboarding to the product, and then possibly per specific feature after it's released, you can probably have an onboarding plan for each of those too. Is that right?
Yeah. And I would actually take a further step back and say really that your product and company as a whole exist in order to make people successful in a specific way. And so anytime that there's a way that you can be making them more successful, there's an opportunity to onboard them even further.
Got it. And how do you draw a line between, say, onboarding and education? So like a lot of customer success departments would focus on things like education. So how do we teach a customer how to get the most out of our product? Is that like conceptually in your head roughly onboarding, or is a line you're comfortable drawing?
I would say that there's no real need to draw a distinction between in-app onboarding versus outside-app onboarding. One thing that I think is really criminally underappreciated are lifecycle emails and using those to get people back into the product for their not just getting through their next activity, but building habits around becoming ongoing users and their second visit, third, fourth, fifth, and so on. So I would certainly say anything in the surrounding ecosystem that helps people get better at what your product helps people get better at is an opportunity for onboarding right there.
Yeah, that makes sense. So I mean, like the way I think of onboarding, like you've got in-product onboarding, you've got out-of-product onboarding, whether that's in email or a webinar or whatever. Then you've got manual onboarding, which might be like a concierge basis, like for some of your like higher paying customers. And you've got like automated onboarding. You've got like, say, guided onboarding, where you're specifically walking people through certain parts of your product in a certain order. And you've got discoverable onboarding, where you're letting people walk wherever they want, but everywhere they arrive, there's a guide for them. It feels like there's been a lot of work done in this area. Like, are there any sort of general trends you're noticing here?
Well, concierge onboarding is something that I'm seeing getting more and more traction. That's really something that historically has been reserved for people that are identified as being higher value accounts and kind of more of a high touch sales process, as opposed to providing some level of human white glove treatment to people who are signing up, whether they really show strong signs of being high value enterprise level customers or not. So that's one thing that I'm seeing. Another trend that I'm typically seeing are basically taking more of an approach to generating an environment that's conducive to people getting value out of your product. So something like forums or communities, things along those lines where disparate people can be helping each other and having a compound effect of value recognition from there as well.
It's interesting, yeah, that both trends, like obviously the concierge is very much takes its lead from like what you would imagine like enterprise software of just the previous generation. I was going to say of old, but it's really just the previous generation where like when a customer is worth many thousand dollars a month, yeah, you'll jump on a call with them and you'll walk through it. But then on the other end, like having like community-based support is certainly a good scalable way to provide some sense of the same in-person interaction without having to shell out for it, I guess, right?
Yep, absolutely. Or, webinars is another thing that I see people leveraging all the time. For example, there was a company I was speaking with just recently where they said they have weekly getting started webinars, and they'll personally reach out to people and say, looks like you just signed up. Maybe if you're not particularly strong in your background for X or Y, this is something that we have happening every week. We'd love it for you to join then. And, you know, that's something that scales really, really well. And it's a really repeatable process on your end. So great way to maximize your own internal resources to really give people that high touch experience.
Yeah, that's, I mean, we run webinars, and that's certainly like what it's the most scalable version of like individually demoing Intercom that I can imagine, for sure.
Mm-hmm.
So let's talk maybe a slightly different question. A lot of people, a lot of onboarding I see kind of blurs two ideas. One idea is like, you know, we need to teach the user how to use this product. And another idea is we need the user to configure their product. So you can imagine, let's say it's a fictitious like time tracking tool. One part of it is here's how you track time. But another part of it is like, you need to set up accounts. You need to invite your team. You need to say how you record errors. Do you think that those two things should sit together, or in the user's mind, are they two different things?
I would actually group those together as being more separate or more similar than they are different. The two distinctions that I really make as far as onboarding are concerned are people making progress in the goal that they were hoping to when they signed up for your product? So, for example, if they sign up for TaxSlayer, are they getting closer to having their taxes filed? Or if they sign up for Basecamp, are they getting closer to managing their projects well? Or in Intercom's case, are they getting closer to being able to talk to their customers better? And so people are aware of you know, kind of a frustrating situation where they feel like they're not really performing to the level that they'd like to, and a more successful situation that they can imagine themselves in, and your product kind of transitioning them from one to the other. And so looking at that as kind of the meta onboarding, that's what I really try to spend the most amount of time thinking about and aligning the experience around, and to really try to minimize the amount of heavy lifting that the here's how you use this particular product or here's how you get better at using this particular product does. As far as onboarding is concerned, typically that's not something that people are going to wake up and really be highly motivated to get better at during that day. They really just want to get better at solving whatever those problems are and you know, with the least amount of learning and the learning curve of your individual product itself.
That's, I mean, that's an interesting thought that occurs to me when you say that, like, in that users' goals are, like, you know, always going to be progress in their own life, whether that's, like, get the taxes paid or let me get back to, like, playing with my children or whatever is important to them.
Mm-hmm.
What I'm interested in is, like, so, like, a user has, like, a highest level goal, which is, like, make progress, like, you know, get taxes paid, whatever. Their intermediary goal is something like learn how to use this damn taxing software so I can make the progress. If you're, like, on the business side of this, you're thinking, you know, your ultimate goal is get this damn user converted so they'll start paying us money. And then your intermediary goal is, like, well, they're only going to convert if they get their taxes paid successfully. Is it, like, we like to talk a lot about making sure that businesses and companies both want the same thing. Are there times when onboarding ends up kind of at a conflicted crossroads where a business literally wants the user to do one thing, whether it's, like, enter your credit card now, whereas the user is not ready to do so, or they actually want something different? Are there, like, have you experienced times where there are conflicted goals in onboarding? And if so, are there good ways to resolve them?
Sure. Yeah, I would certainly say that that's probably any time that there's a design situation where one person's charging and the other person's paying, that there are probably going to be opportunities for goals to not be necessarily 100% aligned. Obviously, it's better when they are, but certainly some onboarding specific examples that come to mind are when, you know, there's kind of the spam your friends part of the sign up process where you're going through maybe a wizard and then it says enter in your email address and, you know, and or unlock, you know, enter in your Twitter account and blast this out to everybody. And maybe not really necessarily directly in the user's best interest, or it doesn't really get them a lot further in what their goals are. But at the same time, might be really helpful to the company as far as what they're pursuing from what you might call a growth hacking or viral kind of factor standpoint. So there are those kind of things. But overall, I would say largely any time that the business can really leverage and harness the motivation that people have to just improve their lives, that's really going to be the purest source of energy in that interaction, really, because looking at the idea of using a website being completely voluntary, the more you can link your success to your user's success, the more likely that the energy will be flowing in the right direction, I guess you can say.
That makes sense. And then, like, shifting gears to design for a second, you're originally a UX designer by trade, right?
Mm-hmm. Correct.
Yeah. And, like, one thing I see is, like if onboarding, like, if you want to call it, like, onboarding 1.0, like, let's say, like, onboarding in, like, the Web 2.0 era, it was very much about, like, a button tour. It was like, look at our merge button, now look at our create account button. And it was just fancy arrows. Sometimes they were hand drawn, or sometimes they were like pop ups, but they were just basically pointing pieces of interface out to you,
right?
Over and over again, in the sense that somehow that's helping the user achieve anything. Like, as if, you know, you can't read the words on this button, but here, why don't you read the words in this dialogue instead?
Right. Yeah. Speaking of Basecamp, Jason Fried, a long time ago, started a Flickr group called Signs on Signs, where he would take pictures of, you know, a sign in a library that, for whatever reason, wasn't getting the job done. So they would, somebody at some point pasted another sign pointing to that sign to draw attention to it, yeah, instead of just making a sign that worked. And he had kind of a fun quip, which is that, you know, he likes it because it's literally people pointing out bad design. And so, a lot of times, if your product is so confusing that people can't understand how to use it, that you need to layer on more interface that literally, you know, oftentimes just repeats what the interface underlying that it's pointing to says, you know, that's obviously there are a lot of issues with that. So I could go on and on about the different reasons why having just a long rote tooltip tour is probably not the best way to approach onboarding or design in general.
I think, it makes total sense. I mean, the approach there is very much like, our interface isn't working. Quick, we need more of it. And it's it's certainly, like, you know, it's not likely to work. It seems to, like, you know, this idea of, like, you know, numbered pointy out the interface, like, the two things that frustrate me about that, one is it has become kind of synonymous with onboarding, is this sense of,
yep,
1, 2, 3, 4, here's our four buttons. We built four buttons. Congratulate us. And and then the second piece is, it tends to be quite, like, inward focused. Like, it's very much, look at us and look at everything we've done. Mm-hmm. Here is what we've built and here is what it does. But, like, there's very much a missing point where they're sort of saying, you can use this to achieve that. That's, like, what I feel a lot of, like, the work you praise and what you talk about in your book is praising, is, like, understanding the user's definition of their success and designing an onboarding experience to help them achieve that. Could you elaborate a little on what's involved there?
Sure. I would say that's a very good way of putting it. Especially, like, if we're going to continue just kind of picking on tooltip tours. Another thing that I see being an issue with them is that they're not necessarily accomplishment oriented, where they might have you go through 7 or 8 steps and you're just kind of tasked with trying to A, reverse engineer what sort of scenario you would be in where that button would be relevant for you, and then try to remember what those 8 different scenarios are for future reference when you actually might wind up in that scenario. So instead of looking at it basically saying, we know what the very first thing that you should be doing is, jump into this right now. We'll come back when you've finished that, or something along those lines. So one thing that I really liken a lot of onboarding experiences to are video games, which have been around a lot longer. And it's something that I really closely studied especially when I was writing the book and just kind of forming my central theses. And anybody who, you know, might remember growing up with the original Nintendo games, like, sometimes they came with, you know, like 100, 130, 150 page booklet that you were kind of supposed to read, because just getting started with the game itself was going to be kind of a confusing and miserable experience. And, you know, I personally never really enjoyed having to go through all this reading material just to play a video game. I would just always, you know, leave the book on the floor and try to play and get frustrated and move on to a game that didn't frustrate me from that standpoint. So kind of looking at the evolution of the knowledge, or the intro book turning into more of a tutorial where it would say, you know, to jump, press A, and to run, press B, and things like that, was kind of a better way to do it, because then people were actually participating and taking action. But at the same time, if it was really overly sandboxed, it didn't feel like a meaningful action that they were taking. And really, where things really took off from a video game learning education standpoint is when you mix the tutorial throughout the game to the point where it became indistinguishable from actually just playing the game. And that's really what I really aspire to from a design standpoint, that if your SaaS product can be so intuitive and well considered that you're getting people to take actions without even really explicitly realizing that they were told to, or having to remember everything right when they sign up, then, you know, that's really the goal.
Yeah, that makes sense. I mean, like, one thing is video games get right, I'm specifically thinking of, like, the first time I played something like Call of Duty here, is, like, a sense of, like, just-in-time education. So, like, they don't teach you anything that you're not about to use. And but like, the complexity of the game arises from the fact that they only teach it to you once. And it's up to you to remember that for future. Because, like, on level 4, when you walk past, like, you know, a door that's locked, they're not going to have a pointer again telling you a key would be useful. It's up to you to work that out this time. I guess, like, with SaaS products, we're not trying to deliberately make these things puzzles, but at the same time, we can't overly annotate the interface and explain every single thing all the time, because it would just be, the product would become unusable, right?
Sure. And that's really something that the best approach that I've seen is really handling blank states a lot better. It's really clear. Speaking also of video game design, from a design standpoint, you can a lot of times tell when the product was kind of designed for the, if you think of, like, getting people up to speed in your product, is going from 0 to 60, the product was designed for 60 the entire way through all the development cycle. And then at the very end, they were like, oh, right, well, we need to kind of have all the other states filled in. So that's when you kind of just slap on a tooltip tour or something like that at the end, when the resources are kind of exhausted, you're about to ship. It's kind of an 11th hour thing. And that's something very similar with video game design, where a lot of times, or actually the opposite, where a lot of times with video games, you'll see that the ending of the game is really underconsidered and boring. But the very beginning of the game, the intro level or the tutorials and things like that, are really, really, really well considered, because they're investing so much of their time in that upfront experience, knowing that if they don't, nobody's ever going to make it to the end to begin with, so it doesn't really matter. And so looking at your ability to use blank states, if you start and say, instead of designing this dashboard for 6 months, what do things look like after you've been using it for 6 months, let's design it for what things look like on the very first time that you log in, or the very, you know, after 1 day's worth of use or 1 week's worth of use, and incrementally getting people through that timeline and designing for that on purpose, as opposed to just kind of going back after the fact and backfilling with kind of a, you know, covering your bases and saying, oh, there's nothing here, come back later, or, you know, kind of admonishing people for having an empty dashboard, which of course they would have to when they sign up to begin with.
So it's funny you say that, because a lot of people are building analytics boards on top of Intercom, and one of the problems they're always faced with is that right after somebody connects Intercom to this dashboard, the dashboard's really boring, basically. Mm-hmm. And the reason it's boring is because they don't have 6 months worth of data. But I think designers, when they sit down to design products, whether it's a, you know, a time tracker or some sort of analytics dashboard, is they fall in love with this world where not only is there, like, enough data there, but the data is really, really interesting as well. It's all spiky and trophy and, like, it's just, it's all over the place. Whereas, like, real data is often real fucking boring. Like, so it's sad that it doesn't get caught that often. So, you know, inevitably the first run experience is underwhelming, both because the data is incomplete, but also it's just not as exciting as the screenshots were. So I guess, like, one thing that you said there interests me is, in terms of blank slate design, and you mentioned this in your book as well, one technique you've seen used a lot lately is this idea of, like, using like educational content as its blank slate. And I've seen this done in, like, say, like, task trackers, where they say, like, you know, step one is to complete this. Or I think John Gruber's Vesper app uses I believe it uses, like, there's notes, and each note explains what you're to do with it, so that you learn all the actions to do with the notes. Mm-hmm. You've seen a few examples of this, I believe.
Yeah, and you know, just to touch on one other aspect of blank slates or states that can be helpful, is it's really an opportunity for you to provide a warm and human experience to your product, that instead of, you know, literally saying your dashboard is empty and that's all I'm gonna say. You know, obviously that's not something that you would be saying if you were in person with the customer. So having your software say that, there's a little bit of a mismatch there. So a company like Slack, for example, will, you know, not only kind of have fun and punchy things that it says to you as it's loading up, but it also walks you through the experience of using Slack in a very affable and personable way that people have really, really connected with. And so not just a matter of being helpful or informative or educational, but just also just being warm and welcoming. So between those two, it's a really, really great opportunity for you to help forge that relationship early on and help people get hit the ground running so that there is a much higher likelihood that they will get to the point where they have boring or interesting data 6 months down the line.
Right, right. That makes sense. What do you make of the emerging trend, I guess? Well, maybe it's not so emerging. It's probably popular now. When people look at their database and they look at what looks to be a great set of users, and then they take some metrics from those users mm-hmm. and use that to inform onboarding. So they might say, well, it looks like people, after they hit 7 friends, they start using our product. So all we need to do is get everyone to hit 7 friends. Does that make sense, or is there too much correlation and causation going on there?
Yeah, I'm much more for it than against it. I think that there's a lot of low-hanging fruit as far as just user behavioral data is concerned, and even just taking a perspective of humility and saying, you know, as I've heard you and many others say very often, that the customer is rarely buying what the company thinks it's selling. So are there inventive ways that people are using your product that never occurred to you and really very strongly correlate with people getting success out of? Those are obviously great things to know just because it helps inform your product design and things like that. You know, however, on the flip side, if you run the numbers and see that people who contact customer support are 6 times more likely to convert to paying customers, so therefore let's try to railroad everybody into talking to customer support, maybe that's, you know, more closely correlated with that being the case because those are the people who are most motivated to sign up for or convert for your product to begin with. And, you know, that's not necessarily going to be a high value step for people. So, you know, obviously you don't want to just kind of turn, go onto autopilot as far as using data is concerned, but having that much more information to be able to be used, I think just makes tons of sense.
That's funny. I mean, the idea of like forcing people to talk to support reminds me of I was speaking with a different entrepreneur who'll remain anonymous yesterday, who came to me with a very, very great database conclusion. And what he concluded was that the leading cause of customer cancellations is charging customers money. and I was like, right. And I was like, okay, so if you want to stop cancellations? And he's like, exactly. And I was like, right. Sounds like we're all set here. One last piece before we kind of wrap up, well, sort of one second last piece, I guess, is it's, you know, your book and your checklist outlines a really good way to sort of go about onboarding. But one thing that I think can easily be forgotten is, how do you maintain your onboarding? So let's say me and you sit down and we designed a perfect Intercom onboarding flow, or even screw perfect, even a really, really good improvement on what's there today. Inevitably, in a year's time, Intercom will have some new features, some features no longer there, a different, you know, some different styles, some different flows. How often do you revisit onboarding? Is it a part of like every project, or, you know, how do you make sure that your product doesn't get ahead of your onboarding?
Sure. So, yeah, that's a good question. I guess that if you are, like, from the very beginning in this conversation, if you are conflating your product to be the progress that you make in people's lives, that your product is not necessarily the software that sits on a server, it's how you make people more successful, then to my mind, the onboarding, the software itself are almost interchangeable. Really, it's just a matter of, can you reliably get people from A to B in their life, which also requires getting people from A to B in your product. That being said, as far as the nature of taking an approach where, you know, it's very, very difficult to get onboarding resources allocated within a company in general. And that's something that I point to, something called Conway's Law, which wasn't really designed for this scenario, but I've sort of adopted it, which is, in short, that what a team produces will be organized in a way that reflects the way that the team was organized. And so a lot of times in typical product companies, you'll see a marketing department or a marketing team and a product department and a product team. The marketing department's primary outcome and KPIs are probably very driven around PR and awareness and things like that that are very early in the funnel and taper off pretty quickly as soon as people have signed up. That's kind of the end outcome for that department. Product, on the other hand, is looking at very, very deep funnel things, retention, advanced users, creating new features, things along those lines, and bridging the gap from someone who's signed up to becoming an advanced user is not typically a primary concern of either department, and there really isn't another department that is primarily concerned with that. So one thing that I see happening more and more with progressive companies is the creation of a growth team or growth department, not necessarily synonymous with growth hacking necessarily, which is kind of a contentious term, but something that really looks in the middle and says, how can we more reliably just drive ongoing engagement of any kind across the entire customer experience? So that being the case, the more companies are investing in that, the more that I see onboarding as being something that's continually being incrementally improved on an ongoing basis and is synonymous in a lot of times with growth itself.
So last question, just to give us an insight into the experience you've had from working on this now for, I guess, the guts of a year and a half.
Mm-hmm.
You take over a product tomorrow due to circumstances beyond the scope of this podcast. And let's say the product has 100,000 active users and you've got 2,000 users signing up every day, but less than 40% of those users are returning after their first session. Okay. Where do you start?
So the very first thing that I would start with is just getting organizational buy-in and getting a high degree of consensus around what is the way that the users' lives are improved in a way that may or may not be completely solely beneficial to the business, but just understanding, you know, once again, just kind of the one-liner version. Basecamp helps people become better at project management. Intercom helps people become better at talking to their customers. Evernote helps people become better at remembering things. Just understanding what is the vector of improvement that we help people achieve in their own lives. And then finding ways to align the company and business experience around capitalizing on providing that improvement as much as possible. So just in very abstract terms, becoming very, very clear on what are the actions that are going to really highly correlate with people finding success? How do we know when people have taken those? How do the people know that who want to take those know when it's time to do that and what they call that? Things along those lines. Going from there, having that abstract alignment around the improvement, I would then look at what are all the reasons that people would be going off course or not really being able to make it through a given workflow of even just what are the basic things that people need to do in order to get value out of the product. So paying close attention to analytics, diving into the metrics, what is it that's causing 60% of the people who sign up to never come back again? Maybe the first run experience, the end goal for that is unclear, or maybe it's too ambitious to be taken care of in a single setting or sitting, things along those lines. So I would just dive into basically running the numbers and seeing what are the success rates for all the different steps that we really think highly correlate with people getting value out of the experience. What is the average time to completion for those different steps, and creating an experience around there that's informed around, basically guiding people to the life that they want to lead.
And would you talk to any of the failed converters, anyone who did sign up but didn't return?
Sure. The three moments in the customer experience that I like to pay the most attention to from a user research or surveying kind of standpoint are when somebody first signed up, just to get an idea of, A, what do you hope to get out of this, and what do you think you're signing up for? And then B, another question that I really like to ask people is, you might have been thinking about this for a couple weeks or a couple months, but for whatever reason, today, you know, Thursday the 13th of November, this was the day that you actually did sign up for this product. What was the external trigger? And I wouldn't use the term external trigger, but for, you know, between us, right, what was the external trigger that caused you, like, today is going to be the day that I do this? You know, obviously looking at like jobs to be done, switch interviews, similar methodology there. So that's one area that I look at. Another area that I really look at is if you have any sort of, you know, let's say you have a free trial, somebody converts to paid, or if you don't charge for your product, whatever kind of engagement proxy you might have where you say, okay, this person is going to be they've crossed the threshold where they're going to be an ongoing user for a very long time. Really getting an idea of what were the things that you accomplished that made it a total no-brainer for you to continue using this. If you were to have not been able to experience one or two features, what would you have really missed the most? Or going through the experience, what was a time where you almost didn't make it all the way through and what almost prevented you from doing that? Those are questions that I really look at. The last one is, as you mentioned, cancellations, just getting an idea of what did you think you were going to get that you didn't, or what could we have done more to, you know, be a better fit for you? That's probably the lowest signal to noise ratio opportunity to talk to customers. A lot of times it's just that their company went under or that they are moving to, you know, a different company or things like that, which is fine, but it's still an opportunity to get some information. You can do that really passively at that standpoint as well.
Right. And okay, so just to wrap up, I mean, I know people can follow you on Twitter and they can go to User Onboard, but could you maybe just give us an overview of what people will find in the book?
So the book is really, people have gone to useronboard.com and, you know, do the teardowns, and they seem to really like the insight that I have around specific onboarding experiences for specific products. The book really endeavors to lay out an underlying philosophy around this is A, the criteria by which I'm reviewing products, and B, how you can take on the similar mindset to approach your own product that way. So looking at how do you evaluate an entire customer experience? How do you determine how aligned that is with the customers becoming successful or not? Things along those lines. It's very much basically what I provide one-to-one as a consultant in an afternoon or more, I've condensed down into book form. So that's ultimately the role of the book.
Excellent. Good stuff. Well, thank you so much for talking to us, Samuel. It's been great. I'm sure our readers and listeners will enjoy it too. And I'll be sure to let them know where they can find out more from you. So thanks so much for your time.
It was great to be here. Thank you so much for having me.